Greetings, SunSounds listeners, and welcome to the Philosopher Program. This is your host, SunSounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Candy Lewis. We begin our program with some daily selections from Science of Mind, Guide for Spiritual Living. And again, this month's selections were written by Reverend Dr. Michael Gott. Grief is sacred. The most beautiful people we have known are those who have known defeat, known suffering, known struggle, known loss, and have found their way out of the depths. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. Plant love in your garden. Kindness and sympathy flow from the heart of love, and human goodness follows divine realization at every turn in life's road. Ernest Holmes, This Thing Called You. The Buddhist disciples were taught not to cling to form. The Five Remembrances Sutra is meant to remind us all that everything we can name or point to is temporary. This does not mean we don't love those forms and experiences while they are here. American poet Mary Oliver puts it this way in her poem, In Blackwater Woods. To live in this world, you must be able to do three things. To love what is mortal, to hold it against your bones, knowing your own life depends on it, and when the time comes to let it go, to let it go. In my experience, this is deep and powerful work. Our New Thought teachings tend to focus on creating the new, not on grieving what is past or passing. But both of these are holy and necessary. To use our principles and practices to create the types of experiences, relationships, and opportunities that feel right to our soul, and to grieve them when their time is through. Grief is not clinging. To grieve someone or something is to fully feel the loss, which is the only true way to come to terms with it, and then to let it go. Affirmation. I let go. I allow the cycles of creation and dissolution to be present in my experience without attachment or suffering. Through each loss, I deepen and reveal more of the good within and all around me. Be someone. Be yourself. Everyone else is taken. Oscar Wilde. God is over all, in all, and through all. God, Spirit, the universe is right where I am. I'm at peace with myself. Ernest Holmes, This Thing Called You. In Houston, there's a famous bit of graffiti on a railroad overpass as you're driving south into downtown. It says, Be Somebody, in blocky capital letters. Dozens, if not hundreds of times, other graffiti was painted over it, but it always returns. Some entrepreneurial someone made t-shirts of it. I have two of them. This simple message resonates with people. We've been given this human lifetime and invited to do something with it. Part of the someone we are invited to be is already within us, our soul, our individualized expression of spirit, and part of it is waiting for us to create something new. We have agency and choice, and these dual invitations to someoneness are not at odds, but rather they serve one another. When we shed enough of our conditioning to sense our innate, unique qualities, the process leads and informs us in what we might do with this one wild and precious life. Today, be courageous in letting go of your patterns of thought and behavior that are not authentic, and listen deeply to what your soul invites you to do so you can be the someone who will most free and fulfill you. Affirmation. I listen to the authentic voice of my being. I choose to live from this deep and genuine place within. I make decisions, take actions, and speak words that honor the someone who I am. And from the Daily Word, published by Unity, understanding. I seek the Christ within and find true understanding. Understanding is a realization of the presence and power of God, of Spirit, of the universe, in every worldly situation. It is the divine gift that allows me to perceive spiritual truth beyond appearances. It is not related to intellectual knowledge, but flows from the indwelling Christ presence, the wisdom within me. True spiritual understanding enables me to act with clarity, compassion, and peace, helping me navigate life with insight. I deepen in spiritual understanding by communing with God, Spirit, the universe within. As I listen for my guidance, my higher perspective transcends worldly concern. By affirming spiritual understanding, I live for my divine identity and bring the truth of God, of Spirit, of the universe into the world. Peace. Perfect peace dwells within me and all beings. As I prepare for a fuller experience of my divinity this Advent season, I turn my attention to cultivating peace of mind and heart. This inner preparation invites me to look beyond my circumstances and attune to the deeper harmony that underlies all creation. Whether I'm in a busy city or a calming natural setting, I trust that each day will dawn in perfect alignment with the heavenly bodies of the cosmos. Likewise, whether I feel anxious or calm, I trust heavenly peace is within me. Aware of my peaceful nature, I choose thoughts, words, and actions that honor my spiritual self. My presence restores calm and chaos and invites serenity to ease distress. My tranquil demeanor magnifies the peace of God, of Spirit, of the universe. And from Mark Nepos, The Book of Awakening, having the life you want by being present to the life you have, work and passion. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. Howard Thurman. I remember when in college, many of us were herded into teaching because there seemed a need in the job force. But by the time we graduated, teaching jobs were scarce. The same thing happened 15 years later when I was teaching college. Many of my students were herded into the study of business. But a few years after graduating, there were very few jobs. This is another way that scarcity can direct our lives. Often when we shape our interests around what others need, we wind up selling our chance at happiness for what we think will be secure. But while supply and demand may work on paper, it can build a loveless life in the world. This is why finding what we love, though it may take years, is building a life of passion. For what makes you come alive can keep you alive, whether you are paid well for it or not. And beyond the fashion of the job market, a life of passion makes us a healthy cell in the body of the world. Center yourself and allow the things that stir you to come into your heart. It may be as simple as watching a candle flicker or running in the wind. Breathe freely and just feel how these things affect your whole body and being. When you can, discuss with a loved one what makes you come alive. And I want to pause for a moment and ask for feedback if you have any to give. I love reading from Mark Nepos, The Book of Awakening, but I can switch to something new for the coming year. If any of you have an opinion and would like me to keep reading from that book instead of starting with something else, let me know, and I thank you. We return now to Science of Mind for an article by Ernest Holmes. Reflections on Christ and Christmas. Christ, the perfect man, is developed within us through the realization and revelation of the self to the self. God, Spirit, the universe in us is Christ, and Christ in us constitutes our true relationship to the parent mind, which is God, Spirit, the universe. Everyone is a potential Christ, an as yet undeveloped divinity. From the least to the greatest, the same life runs through all, threading itself in the patterns of our individualities. It is over all, in all, and through all. This overbrooding presence, this inner sense of a greater reality, bears witness to itself through our highest acts and in our deepest emotions. Who is there who has not at times felt this inner presence? It is impossible to escape our true nature. The voice of truth is insistent. The urge to unfold is constant. In the long run, each of us will fully express our divinity. We stand in the shadow of a mighty presence, while love forever points the way to heaven. Mingled with the voice of humanity is the word of God, of Spirit, of the universe. For truth is a synonym for God, and whoever speaks the truth speaks the word of God, of Spirit, of the universe. Science reveals eternal principles, mathematics, immutable laws, and illumined minds reveal the eternal Spirit. Behind all is a unity. Through all is a diversity. Saturating all is a divinity. The Christ that Jesus revealed is already incarnated in our own nature, and this hidden center seeks to find circumference through our lives. The intellect must give its consent, and the mind must unify with the Spirit. The outlet for truth must be true. Christmas is for remembrance. The love manifested through our gifts to each other typifies the offering of life, the givingness of Spirit to its creation. The hands of the Eternal are outstretched through our hands, and the heart of the Infinite beats in the human breast. But the giver must give of themself, for the gift without the giver is bare. It is not enough to give money to a great cause. Only those who give of themselves, withholding nothing, understand giving. It is not, then, in lavish gifts that we find true giving, but in the sweet simplicity of remembrance, in the kindly thought, the tolerant mind, and the gentle act. Love alone can give love. Sympathy alone can sympathize, and only goodness can really do or be good. The one who gives for reward does not give at all. He seeks to bargain, to trade for spiritual gifts. Hence, he senses a loss in his own giving and finds no completion through the act. But he who gives half his meat to the hungry feels justified and is warmed by a real sense of comradeship. He has established an actual unity between himself and another offspring of creation. Great causes succeed when there is a giving of humanity to humanity. With the check must come the one who wrote it, her interest, her enthusiasm, her love. The check must be a symbol of her desire to impart of herself. Then shall it multiply its benefits and do good. Charity is cold, but love is warm. When heart speaks to heart, a divine conversation has taken place, a heavenly discourse. Each of us has something to give. Let each see that he gives of his best. If we are bringing our gifts to the altar of love, nothing less than the best will be acceptable. Nothing less than all is enough. This giving will never deplete us, nor can it drain the storehouse of the infinite. Meditation. The joy of the Christmas spirit is eternally mine. The comfort of the Christ idea finds an abiding place in my consciousness. The Christ within. My life is hid with Christ in God. The inner self is the image and likeness of the Spirit of God. I let that inner self come forth into expression in my life. The inner self will guide my feet into all truth and wisdom. Christ within me is free from all worry and cannot be hindered by any opposing force. My Christ within me now is perfect. My Christ is within me. The unassailable truth and the irresistible word. Whatever the nature of truth is, we may be sure truth is the last analysis of any principle. The truth about electricity, for example, is that there is an electric energy that surrounds us, which energy we may draw upon if we first comply with its nature and law. The truth of electricity works through our application of its principle according to its own law. We did not make this law. We cannot change it. We can only use it. Electricity is but one of the infinite number of lesser principles we find in the universe. An energy more subtle than electricity will no doubt someday be discovered. Meanwhile, we shall do well to make use of what we know and understand. Eternal unfoldment and evolution seem to be the law of our being. But what is it that unfolds? Is it the principle or the personality? The question is a superfluous one, for we all know that principles do not evolve, while persons do. Our evolution consists in the constant acquirement of knowledge leading to a more profound understanding of life and principles, but our understanding of principles does not create them. Principles are immutable, changeless, and eternal. It should not seem strange that human endeavor should have discovered the principle of electric energy. It does not seem strange, although it does appear marvelous. It should not seem strange that the principle of mental and spiritual energy should have been discovered through the human mind. All the discoveries that have been made in the human experience and given to us, all the benefits accruing from these discoveries, have come through this channel. When electricity was first discovered, it seemed miraculous, and to many the energy of mind seems to work a miracle. We are too bound with superstition. When the thunder broke, our ancestors thought that the gods were angry or quarreling, while the rainbow appeared to them to be the smile of God. We are no longer as crudely superstitious as they, but we are more subtly so. An answered prayer is looked upon with awe as well as reverence, and many still think that God, Spirit, the universe, holds evil in store for the unbelieving. Why should we look upon the manifestations of mind with superstition, unless it is that we do not fully understand them? The ideas brought out dimly in these lessons will someday be more clearly taught in our schools. The age of superstition will have passed, and the dawn of exact knowledge will have come into the field of the study of mind. Today, the knowledge is more accurate than many believe. Today, a science of mind is being worked out that is built on a proven and demonstrable principle. Just what do we know about this principle? We know that it is, and we know something of the way in which it works, but we do not know all about it. We know a little, but the little proves the more, and the more will come only as we first make use of the little. We know that we are surrounded by a law that works on our word, thought, or belief. We know that this is the principle through which faith and prayer operate. We know that faith and true prayer are actual energies working through an intelligent principle. We know this because we have proved it sufficiently to be sure of the law involved. The only way we can know any principle is from what it does and how it responds to our approach to it. There's nothing strange or weird about the principle of mind and spirit. The discovery of mind was made when we first began to think. The discovery of spirit was made when we first realized that we are not alone in the universe. From these two great discoveries, the science of mind and spirit has gradually evolved. There is no secret about this. Everyone knows that they have a mind, and nearly everyone believes that they are surrounded by spirit. Like all truths, when understood, this truth is simple and may be approached directly. Truth is not something divulged to the elect by a jealous deity, nor is it given to a chosen few by direct revelation from a capricious god. Truth is a universal presence, waiting to be understood and made use of. Let us resolutely brush aside all superstitions and discredit any attempt by whomsoever made to cover that which will not be concealed. We have a mind, and we are surrounded by mind. This is simple enough. We think, and thought is an energy. Anyone can understand this. Conscious thought is an energy definitely directed. There is nothing occult about this. A child could understand it. It does not have to be thundered from Sinai nor scraped from the esoteric teachings of any antiquity. Intelligent thought is an intelligent energy. What makes it so? No one knows. It is so. But there is more to it than this, because thought is an energy. This energy must flow from thought. And the more spiritual the thought, the finer the energy. But what is spiritual thought? That kind of thought which believes that good is the ultimate and absolute power of the universe. Meditation. The truth within me is unassailable, and the power of the word is irresistible. I can even now feel that my word has gone forth with power and reality, and that it will accomplish that purpose for which it was created. Limitless is its power, and wonderful are its works. It can be nothing less than the Almighty working in and through me. I will let this word of the Spirit go forth from my mouth and heal and bless the world. It shall be as a stronger tower unto all who call upon it. The truth is complete and perfect and is within me now. My word is complete and perfect now. This feature is excerpted from Ernest Holmes' article in Religious Science magazine from December 1929. And most issues of Religious Science, Science of Mind magazine, are available at scienceofmindarchives.com. And from the same issue, we turn to Reverend Dr. David Alexander's monthly column, Philosophy in Action, Putting the Christ in Christmas. One of the truly great gifts this teaching has given the world is the illuminated understanding of Christ consciousness, as demonstrated in this month's feature article by Ernest Holmes. What thought could be more liberating to a world gripped in dogma than the simple truth that the presence of Christ is a principle of consciousness rather than a secret possession of any one religion? This is definitely the most illuminating truth of the ages. In New Thought, we hold that the consciousness of love, inclusion, compassion, and healing that is revealed in the man Jesus is that of a universal Christ principle. As such, this same Christ principle has revealed itself in sages and saints throughout human history, Buddha, Zoroaster, Muhammad, and it is still seeking expression in our time. Each time this consciousness breaks through the hypnosis of the conditioned thinking of lack and limitation, it does so uniquely, dressed in the culture and language of a particular time and place, all while revealing a universal truth. This revelation does not take away from the story of Christianity, it adds to it. The Christian story is a unique one, yet not one to be held out as more special than others. It is there, in the subtle understanding of unique versus special, that we find the path to peace. We are each a unique expression of God, of spirit, of the universe, but none more special than the others. When we honor our uniqueness, not only does diversity flourish, but so too does the unity behind diversity begin to reveal itself. What greater gift could we give to the world? So yes, it is time to put the Christ back in Christmas, the universal Christ, the inclusive and welcoming of the stranger Christ. It's time to put loving and forgiveness Christ back in Christmas. It is time we bring forward this Christ consciousness in our actions, words, and deeds among all our neighbors, and not just those who think like or agree with us. As we strive to do so, maybe the gift we can unwrap for the world is one that returns the temperature of our collective experience to that of love, peace, and justice for all in our public discourse. Travel well. We turn now to the November-December 2025 issue of Spirituality and Health, a Unity publication, and to Sylvia Hayes' monthly column, Sacred Earth Connections. And she spells it C-Y-L-V-I-A. She's a speaker, author, and Unity minister. Her Substack, Transcend, is about raised consciousness, economic system change, and a world that works better for all. She's also the former First Lady of Oregon. Visit Sylvia Hayes, CylviaHayes.com. A Christmas Gift to Earth. Over the years, my take on Christmas has shifted a lot. I was taught it was a celebration of the birth of Jesus, but really it was all about the presents. My family was of modest means, but my parents got serious about Christmas, and I loved it. I'm a member of Gen X, known as the latchkey generation, because both parents worked, so we came home to an empty house after school. That was just fine by me, because it provided an opportunity. For several years, driven by curiosity and anticipation, I sneakily opened Christmas presents, played with them, then rewrapped them before my parents got home. I then daydream about the new items and practice a surprise look for the day of ritual. As a young adult, spiritual curiosity ignited. I left the dogma of my youth, and deeper meanings for the holidays emerged. Stacking up historical accounts and Bible stories, it's almost certain Jesus wasn't born in winter. However, early Christian governments couldn't stamp out ancient pagan celebrations held around the winter solstice, so instead, they laid the Christ story over top of them. Although it was a harsh attempt by one culture to blot out another, there is meaningful symmetry between the stories. On one hand, seekers followed the light of a star to witness a miracle. On the other, nature-oriented folks celebrated making it through the longest night of the year to move once again toward light and warmth. Light, in fact, is a central theme of winter holidays in such diverse traditions as Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, Diwali, and of course, the winter solstice. The tradition of giving during Christmas started in a very different form than giving presents to friends and family. Instead, it was more like trick-or-treat at Halloween. Poor people, peasants, apprentices, and servants, wandered around knocking on the doors of rich people and demanding gifts of good food, money, and drinks. If they got it, they'd toast the person who gave it to them and wish them goodwill. If they didn't, they might leave a nasty trick instead. It was an exchange between social classes. Eventually, the rich got tired of the public begging and created the story of Santa Claus dropping gifts for children. Present giving later became a matter of parents giving to their own children, and the idea of Christmas shopping was born. People weren't going to get their own kids drunk, and giving them food they ate the rest of the year wasn't special, so they had to shop. Merchants seized on this, and Christmas eventually became the most commercialized of holidays. Now it takes effort to tune out the endless calls to buy, 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 and focus on deeper meanings. The consumption-based approach also takes a toll on the earth. During the holidays, waste in the United States increases by a whopping 25%. Food waste, wrapping paper, shopping bags, Christmas cards, bows, ribbons, boxes, decorations, lights, and plastic create an additional 1 million tons of trash per week. In the long dark night of winter, before the flip of a switch could illuminate a room or a shopping mall, ancient peoples tuned into the seasons and rhythms of nature and the wonder and beauty of shared traditions. With intention, modern humans can do the same. Action idea. A web search will turn up many tips for reducing waste during the holidays. My favorites include giving experiences instead of stuff, online classes or gift certificates for restaurants or massage, using reusable gift bags or cloth towels as wrapping paper, and decorating a live tree that we plant outside afterward. And from the same issue, we turn to Rabbi Rami Shapiro's monthly column, Roadside Assistance for the Spiritual Traveler. And we'll share part of this today. Why isn't my meditation working? After years of meditation, I still haven't experienced the awakening many people talk about. What am I doing wrong? How can I tell if my meditation is working? Rabbi Rami, what you're doing wrong is listening to people talk about their awakening. There is no you in the moment of awakening. That's why Zen Master Dogen speaks of Shinjin Datasaraku, dropping off body and mind, and the Kabbalists of Kalta Nafshi, the ending of self. If you're experiencing awakening, it isn't awakening you are experiencing. Your meditation is working if you recognize that your life is permeated by the universal happening, Tao in Chinese, Yiva in Hebrew, which is reality, and then your living becomes increasingly just, kind, and loving. I'm not religious, and my religious friends insist that without religion I have no morality, only personal whim. What are they talking about? Many believe that morality must come from God because, as Fyodor Dostoevsky wrote in The Brothers Karamazov, without God all things are permitted. However, considering the evil committed in the name of God, one could just as easily argue, with God all things are permitted. It's better to base your morality on the goal of relieving suffering for all beings rather than on a God who often seems to enjoy the suffering of those beings. God's theologians disdain. After confessing to a coworker that I had broken several of the Ten Commandments, she told me that without Jesus' forgiveness, I'll burn in hell forever. I'm Jewish. How should I respond to this? I would answer this way. Like Jesus, I'm a Jew. Jews don't believe in a God who permits eternal damnation. Our rabbis taught Jesus and me that God judges people based on the good they do rather than the mistakes they make. Therefore, while I strive to turn from evil and do good, I don't need to be saved from my mistakes or your God. My brother has early onset Alzheimer's disease. I believe this is the will of God, yet I pray daily that God will change his mind and heal my brother. Am I wrong to do this? I'm sorry to hear about your brother's struggles. Let me suggest that your prayer isn't about trying to change God's mind. It's about expressing love for your brother. In this context, there is no wrong way to pray. Just remember, God is reality, that in whom we live and move and have our being. The will of God reflects reality, which includes early onset Alzheimer's disease. By all means, pray for your brother's recovery, and also pray that you have the courage and compassion to walk with him through this challenging journey, regardless of how things turn out. A friend of mine read a story about composer John Cage, whose musical mentor, Arnold Schoenberg, told Cage that he would either master harmony or forever face a wall blocking his progress. In that case, Cage said, I will devote my life to beating my head against that wall. This reminds me of repeatedly banging my head against the wall, separating me from God. What's the difference? The difference is that your wall is an illusion. You imagine this wall to sustain the illusion of a separate I, distinct from the infinite non-dual I am that encompasses all existence. You keep hitting your head against this wall to impress yourself and others with your spiritual zeal. Stop your spiritual virtue signaling. See through the illusion of a separate self and recognize the truth. God, spirit, the universe is all there is. Well, we'll pause here to remind you that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, 24 hours of programming from over 300 publications, and you're currently listening to the Philosopher Program with your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Candy Lewis. And if you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcast info and audio on demand. We return now to the Book of Joy. His Holiness the Dalai Lama, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, with Douglas Abrams. And this section is entitled, Illness and Fear of Death. I prefer to go to hell. The trip was bookended by funerals. We had to change the flight itinerary to India and back twice because dear friends of Archbishop Tutu had died. Although these were funerals for men who had lived good long lives, it was a fitting reminder of death and of the limited time each of us has. Certainly, illness and mortality are two of the great verities and sources of suffering in our lives. Be careful. Lots of my friends are dying, the Archbishop said when we had just arrived at the airport, wagging a finger at the Dalai Lama. Then he went on to say what a great man Philip Potter, one of the deceased, had been. He was the first black general secretary of the World Council of Churches, he explained. But with the Archbishop, sanctity and levity, death and life were close bedfellows. So even as he was honoring his friend, he began to tell a joke. He was a very formidable man, much taller than you and me. Yesterday I was looking at his coffin. It was a massive thing. Both of us would have gone in there, and I would have gone to heaven. Then where would you have gone? Most probably hell, the Dalai Lama replied. The conversation about death and who was going to heaven and hell was one of the jokes that they played with throughout the week, making fun of their traditions and conflicting pieties. I asked them to make the subject of illness and death more personal. How do you think about your own deaths? You're both in your 80s, and it's a reality, or at least a possibility, hopefully far in the future. Quite polite, the Dalai Lama said, and laughed. Well, he doesn't mind too much, the Archbishop cut in, pointing at the Dalai Lama, because for him, there's reincarnation. With reincarnation, the Dalai Lama responded, I'm not really sure where I will be born, so much uncertainty, but you are quite sure you are going to heaven. Since the Chinese say they are going to decide where you are reincarnated, the Archbishop responded, you must be nice to them. The Archbishop then looked down as if focusing inwardly on the seriousness of the question, his own mortality. I should say that for a very long time, the thoughts of my demise was something that brought a great deal of anxiety. I know I've had a number of near-fatal illnesses. As a child, I had polio, and they say that my father went off to buy the wood for making my coffin, and my mother went off to get herself black clothes because they thought I was at the end. In my teenage years, I developed tuberculosis and went to a TB hospital, where I noticed that almost all of the patients who started to hemorrhage, coughing up blood, ended up being pushed out on a trolley to the mortuary. I must have been about 15 or so when I began coughing up blood, too. I was sitting down with this receptacle in front of me, and each time I coughed, blood just came out that way. I said, God, if this is curtains for me, then it's okay. I have to admit that I was surprised at the calm and the peace that came over me. Well, of course, you know that they didn't wheel me out on a trolley to the mortuary. Many years later, I met up with Archbishop Trevor Huddleston, who used to come when I was in hospital and visit me weekly for months on end. So it was many years after, when we were both archbishops, that he said he was told by the doctor, your young friend, meaning me, is not going to make it. Well, I guess I seem to have made it for a bit since then. I've often thought about the strength that the Archbishop gained from facing illness and death so early in life. Illness is one of the most common sources of suffering and adversity that people face. And yet even here, as with my father, people can find meaning and spiritual growth in it. In many ways, it's probably the most common motivation for people to reevaluate and transform their lives. It's almost a cliche that people with serious or life-threatening illnesses start to savor each moment and to be more fully alive. I worked on a book many years ago with a physician who cared for seriously ill and dying patients. He made a powerful distinction between healing and curing. Curing involves the resolution of the illness, but was not always possible. Healing, he said, was coming to wholeness and could happen whether or not the illness was curable. The Archbishop explained how he was planning to be cremated, to conserve space, and wanted a simple funeral to encourage others in his country to avoid the expense of caskets and ceremonies that are traditional. Even in death, moral leaders teach by their choices. Then the Archbishop looked at me and said with a common sense finality, death is a fact of life. You are going to die. The Archbishop continued, it's actually a wonderful thing to do what they call a living will, where you're giving instructions for when the end comes. It's not being morbid. You're saying this is a fact of life. I've conducted a number of funerals myself, and I have come to the stage where I'm saying, by the way, this is where you're going. That could so easily be you now. Yes, of course, there is a kind of nostalgia for the things that you have had that you will miss. I will miss my family. I will miss the person who has been my partner for these 60 years. There are many things that I will miss, but in this Christian tradition to which I belong, I will be entering into a fuller life. It is wonderful. I mean, imagine if we didn't die. Our poor world would not be able to carry the burden. It's not able to carry the burden of 7 billion as it is. I mean, I've had a beginning, I've had a middle, and I'll have an end. There's a lovely symmetry about it. Symmetry. He He laughed as he lingered over the word and repeated it. If we didn't die, imagine the number of people that would be in the world now. I hope that the things I believe about heaven are really true, that I will meet my loved ones, my parents, my older brother whom I didn't know because he died in infancy. I will meet many wonderful stalwarts. I want to meet St. Augustine. I want to meet St. Thomas Aquinas and people who have taught us so much about praying. Because God is God, because God is infinite, because none of us who are creatures will ever fathom the infinitude that is God, heaven is going to be forever a place of new discovery. The Archbishop's eyes were transfixed, his gaze distant. I would say, "Oh God, you're so beautiful." And I will call, "Come, come and see." And this other one will say, "Have you seen just how beautiful God is?" The Archbishop fell silent. Perhaps death and the fear of death is truly the greatest challenge to joy. Well, when we are dead, it does not really matter, because it is the fear of its approaching, of the suffering that often precedes it, and ultimately the fear of the oblivion and the loss of our personhood that frighten us. Many psychologists say that the fear of death lies behind all other fears, and many historians of religion argue that religion arose to try to solve the mystery of death. Modern life keeps that fear at bay, as we don't interact with the very old or the very sick, and illness, frailty, and death get tucked away behind institutional walls from our everyday lives. After a few moments, the Dalai Lama began speaking. I think, for thousands of years, the human mind has been curious about death, and many traditions have many ideas and concepts of what will happen next. Heaven, as you mentioned, is a beautiful understanding. Shintoism in Japan also has the idea that after death, you automatically go to heaven where all your ancestors are living. When many people think about death, they are very, very afraid. Usually I tell them that you should accept that death is part of our life. There's a beginning and there's an end, as you mentioned. So once we accept that it is normal and that sooner or later it will come, our attitude changes. Some people are embarrassed when asked about their age or pretend that they're still young. This is silly. Deceiving oneself. We should be realistic. Yes, yes, the Archbishop agreed. If a person is sick, the Dalai Lama said, it is much better to accept that you have some kind of illness and get medical treatment rather than saying nothing is wrong and deceiving yourself. While the Archbishop was in Dharamsala, we'd arranged for him to see Yeshi Dondon, one of the Dalai Lama's doctors. Rachel is an integrative physician and was interested to know if this revered healer might have helpful recommendations for the Archbishop, whose prostate cancer was back. In an amazing coincidence, Dr. Dondon had helped cure my mother of blood cancer while he was visiting New York many years ago, when I was still in high school. When I was in Dharamsala in January preparing for the visit, I was told that Dr. Dondon had died, but I had just heard that he was still alive at almost 90. I was excited to meet him, to thank him for helping to save my mother's life, and to see if he might be able to help the Archbishop. He came into the Archbishop's bedroom at the hotel, his bald head and large ears making him look a little like an only slightly taller Yoda from the Star Wars movies. His face was impassive, and his hands had a powerful delicacy while they took the Archbishop's pulse. The Archbishop was lying on his king-size bed. Through the windows, the valleys of Dharamsala plunged down in steep hillsides of oaks and evergreens, ending with a vista of the vast plains below. Through a translator, Dr. Dondon began to describe health issues that the Archbishop had experienced decades ago and that had led to his current prostate cancer. The Archbishop looked surprised as Rachel, who was familiar with many traditional medical systems, explained what Dr. Dondon was saying in a way that made sense to a modern medical understanding of the body. After a 15 or 20-minute exam, Dr. Dondon pointed to the can of Coke Zero on the bedside table. The Archbishop has given up the rum and Cokes he used to favor, but he's still quite fond of his Coke Zero, having agreed to the diet soda to cut down on his sugar consumption. According to Dr. Dondon, the Coke Zero was still not helping his health and should be removed from his diet. When this was translated to the Archbishop, he got out of his bed rather spryly and jokingly waved his hand, saying, "I think it's time for you to go." Rachel assured the Archbishop that while she'd been trying to get him to kick his Coke Zero habit for years, at 84 he was allowed to eat and drink what he pleased. Dr. Dondon made some additional recommendations. Photos were taken together of the famous doctor and famous patient, and then the good doctor left. As a Buddhist practitioner, the Dalai Lama said, I take seriously the contemplation of the Buddha's first teaching about the inevitability of suffering and the transient nature of our existence. Also, the Buddha's last teaching at the time of his death ends with the truth of impermanence, reminding us how it is the nature of all things that come into existence to have an end. The Buddha said nothing lasts. So it is important that in our daily meditation practice, we continue to think about our own mortality. There are two levels of impermanence. At the grosser level, life keeps changing and things cease to exist, including us. At the more subtle level, in every single moment, everything is changing, something science is able to show us happening, even at the atomic and subatomic level. Our body is constantly changing, as is our mind. Everything is in a constant state of change. Nothing remains static, and nothing remains permanent. In fact, as the Buddha reminds us, the very causes that have given rise to something, such as our life, have created the mechanism or the seed for that thing's eventual end. Recognizing this truth is an important part of the contemplation on impermanence. Then I ask why impermanence happens. The answer is because of interdependence. Nothing exists independently. So this kind of contemplation is part of my usual daily meditation practice. This practice is actually to help one prepare for death, the intermediate state, and then rebirth. So in order to carry out the practice effectively, you should reflect on these things and visualize the process of death. Finally, I think you mentioned that we old people should prepare for death, and it is important to make space for the future, for younger generations. What is important to remember is that sooner or later death comes, and to make our life meaningful while we're alive. I think maximum lifespan is about 100 years. Compared to human history, 100 years is quite short. So if we utilize that short period to create more problems on this planet, our life would be meaningless. If we could live for 1,000,000 years, then maybe it would be worthwhile to create some problems. But our life is short. Now, you see, we are guests here on this planet, visitors who have come for a short time, so we need to use our days wisely to make our world a little better for everyone. Jinpa explained that there is a profound teaching by an ancient Tibetan master. The true measure of spiritual development is how one confronts one's own mortality. The best way is when one is able to approach death with joy. Next best way is without fear. Third best way is at least not to have regrets. So, earlier I was explaining about the night that we fled from Norbolinka, the Dalai Lama said, now turning to his own experiences of facing the fear of death. For me, that was the most frightening night of my life, the night of the 17th of March, 1959. At that time, my life really was in danger. I still remember the alertness of mind I felt as I stepped out of the Norbolinka Palace in disguise, dressed in a Tibetan layman's clothes. All my efforts to calm down the situation in Lhasa had failed. A huge crowd of Tibetans had gathered outside the Norbolinka Palace, wanting to block any attempts on the part of the Chinese military to take me away. I had tried my best, but both sides, the Chinese and the Tibetans, were deeply entrenched in their positions. Of course, the Tibetan side was deeply devout and was trying to protect me. The Dalai Lama paused and looked reflective as he recalled the devotion of his people and their self-sacrifice for his safety. This spontaneous gathering of Tibetans outside Norbolinka Palace was the culmination of days of uprising against the communist Chinese occupation by the Tibetan people that first began on March 10, 1959. This time the public had come to prevent the Chinese authorities from taking the Dalai Lama away from Norbolinka Palace, supposedly for his own personal safety. Something had to happen. The situation was explosive, and the Dalai Lama knew that it could only lead to a massacre. So that night, the 17th of March, 1959, the plan for my escape was executed. We went at night and in disguise along a road that followed a river. On the other side of the river was a Chinese military barracks. We could see the guards. No one in our party was allowed to use flashlights, and we tried to minimize the sound of the horses' hooves. But still, there was danger. If they saw us and opened fire, we were finished. Yet, as a Buddhist practitioner, I thought of Shantideva's somewhat stern advice. If there is a way to overcome the situation, then instead of feeling too much sadness, too much fear, or too much anger, make an effort to change the situation. If there's nothing you can do to overcome the situation, then there is no need for fear or sadness or anger. So I told myself at that moment that even if something were to happen to me, it would still be okay. You face the facts, the reality, and making an attempt to escape was the best response in the face of that reality. Actually, fear is part of human nature. It's a natural response that arises in the face of a danger. But with courage, when in fact real dangers come, you can be more fearless, more realistic. On the other hand, if you let your imagination run wild, then you exacerbate the situation further and then bring more fear. Many people on this planet worry about going to hell, but this is not much use. There is no need to be afraid. While we remain on the earth worrying about hell, about death, about all the things that could go wrong, we will have lots of anxiety and we will never find joy and happiness. If you are truly afraid of hell, you need to live your life with some purpose, especially through helping others. So, the Dalai Lama firmly said, slapping the Archbishop on the wrist playfully, I prefer to go to hell than to heaven. I can solve more problems in hell. I can help more people there. Meditation. Now, I'll tell you a secret thing. We arrived at the Dalai Lama's complex early in the morning as the sun was still waking up. We went through the vigilant security, which reminded us that not all were as loving toward the Dalai Lama as he was toward them. I had decided to see the pat-down, not unlike those we are often subjected to at airports, as a brief massage, rather than as an intrusion of my personal space or as an accusation of my potential danger. I was already learning how much one's perspective shaped one's reality. We crossed the brief distance to the Dalai Lama's private residence. We were later told that some of the people who had worked with the Dalai Lama for 30 years had never been inside. This was his retreat, one of the few places where this very public man could experience solitude, and it was a great privilege to be welcomed into his inner sanctum. From the outside, the Dalai Lama's home is a yellow-painted concrete structure with a green roof, like so many in Dharamsala. The double doors and walls have plenty of glass to let in the high-altitude light. On the roof is a balcony, where the Dalai Lama can take a morning constitutional and look out at his beloved greenhouse filled with purple, pink, and white delphiniums and marigolds bursting like tiny suns. Beyond, he can see a panoramic vista down to the lush green Indian plains, and in the other direction, the towering glacial Dauladhar mountains, cloaked in white snow year-round. While far less grand than the Potala of his youth, his residence has a modest elegance and warmth that the endless thousand-room palace, with its empty, ghost-haunted rooms, must have lacked. We followed the Dalai Lama and the Archbishop into the house as the now brightening light streamed in through the glass window panels. The curtains were held back with ties, and the ceiling was painted black and red. The hallway was hung with brightly colored thangas, and the hall was narrowed by bookshelves piled high with golden-spined sacred texts. Now this is my, how do you say, living room. A prayer room, the Dalai Lama explained. It seemed fitting that his living room was his prayer room, since so much of his life is spent in prayer and meditation. As we entered the room, we saw a large glass-tin altar with a statue of a somewhat emaciated Buddha. Along the sides of the case were traditional Tibetan sacred texts, which looked like rectangular blocks. This altar was similar to a brake front in a Western home that might be filled with silver or porcelain objects. On a ledge was a tablet displaying the face of a clock, which timed out the hours. As we entered the room, we saw a much larger altar, which was also encased in glass. Now this statue, the Dalai Lama said, introducing the Archbishop to the standing Buddha at the center, is from the 7th century. Am I right? The Dalai Lama asked, turning to Jinpa. Right, 7th century, Jinpa confirmed. He was a member of the monastery where this statue once stood, the Dalai Lama said, pointing to Jinpa, known as Kirong Jowo. Literally, the brother from Kirong, this statue of the Buddha is revered as one of the most precious religious treasures of the Tibetan people. It was clothed in a traditional Tibetan robe and crowned with a golden jeweled coronet. It was surrounded by dozens of smaller statues of the Buddha and other sacred figures and was framed by white and purple orchids. The statue is beautifully carved sandalwood and its face was painted gold. The eyes were wide set, the eyebrows thin, the lips curving, the whole face serene. The statue's right hand was extended, palm up, in a gentle gesture of welcome, acceptance, and generosity. Wonderful, the Archbishop said. Originally, there were two similar statues, both carved from the same single piece of sandalwood. And since the time of the 5th Dalai Lama, one was housed in the Potala Palace, the Dalai Lama explained. The Great Fifth, as he is often called, lived in the 17th century and united central Tibet, ending its many civil wars. He is the Charlemagne of Tibet. Well, maybe the Charlemagne and the Pope combined. While one statue was in the Potala, he said, this statue was in Western Tibet. They were like two brothers, twins. So eventually, when the Chinese army destroyed the Potala, that one was killed. It might have been a misspoken word, but his personification of the statue and its death did seem quite poignant. Then the monks in Western Tibet smuggled this one out of Tibet and into India. So then there was a question of whether it should go with the monks of that monastery to South India, where they were resettled, or stay here with me. I made some investigations in the mysterious way, divinations, which I think you also have in African culture. So then this statue, how do you say? He spoke in Tibetan to Jinpa, who then translated. The divination revealed that the statue preferred to stay with the one who is more famous. Everyone laughed. Now, I'll tell you a secret thing, something quite unique. Each morning, you see, I pray to this statue. Then I see his facial expression changing. The Dalai Lama had a mischievous look, and it was hard to know whether he was pulling the archbishop's leg. Really, the archbishop said, trying not to sound too incredulous. The Dalai Lama rocked his head from side to side as if to say, maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. Then the archbishop asked, does it smile? Yes, it is smiling like you, really, the Dalai Lama said as he leaned in and touched foreheads with the archbishop. Then, wagging a finger at him, he added quickly, oh, but not like your eyes, so big and round. The Dalai Lama's eyes went wide with an expression that could be surprise, fear, or anger. Okay, now our session. But as he walked to his chair, he stopped at another altar in the center of the room. On the round table was a very lifelike crucifix, carved out of white marble, with black nails sticking out of the palms of the hands. There is also a statue of the Madonna. Now, this is a black Madonna from Mexico. The statue was of Mary wearing a golden robe and crown and holding a golden orb of our world. On her lap was a small baby Jesus. Mary is a symbol of love, the Dalai Lama said, gesturing at the statue with the same open palm of the sandalwood Buddha. It's wonderful. There is also a deep blue globe nested in a golden stand, a sacred symbol perhaps of another kind, and a tangible reminder of the Buddhist understanding of interdependence. The Dalai Lama's prayer practice and concern, like the archbishop's, enveloped the whole world. The Dalai Lama showed the archbishop over to a heavily cushioned beige chair with a high-winged back. The archbishop wore a navy blue Tibetan shirt with the button in the corner near the shoulder, which made the shirt seem like a pouch into which he had been snugly fit. A skilled tailor, Lama Tenzin's father, had specially made it for him as a gift. The archbishop sat down, his small frame practically disappearing into the large chair. The rest of us began to sit down on the floor, and the Dalai Lama asked whether we wanted chairs, but we said we were quite happy. Originally, I also used to sit on the floor, the Dalai Lama said, but I started to have this problem with my knees, so now I prefer like this. He gestured to a wide chair draped in a red velvety fabric. He pulled his robes up a little and sat down. Behind him, a yellow, red, and green thangka hung on the wall. In front of him was a low wooden table with a stack of Buddhist texts shaped like horizontal literary blocks. The two long thin lamps, sentinels, on either side of the table likely lit the table and the long Tibetan scriptures in the early mornings when the Dalai Lama began his practice. A pot of pink tulips and a gold-colored bowl for ceremonial rice throwing added some color. Finally, two slender tablets also stood on the crowded table, one to display the weather and the other to listen to BBC News. Because of our program, today I started my meditation at 2:30. The archbishop said, perhaps still marveling at this very early rising. Then, as usual, shower and then continue with my meditation practice. Now, you feel okay? Temperature is okay? The Dalai Lama was extending his hands with concern. The archbishop smiled and gave him the thumbs up. Thank you, the archbishop said as they settled in beside each other. This part is a clear light of death meditation, the Dalai Lama said, as if he were about to lead us into a meditation focusing on the breath and not the wasting away of our bodily form. We are training our mind by going through quite a detailed process for what we will experience at the time of death. The archbishop said with wide eyes, as if he had just been invited to warm up for the spiritual Olympics with a short marathon. According to Buddhist Vajrayana psychology, there are different levels of consciousness, the Dalai Lama said, referring to the esoteric Buddhist tradition, which aims to help the practitioner discover ultimate truth, There's a dissolution that occurs as the grosser levels of our bodily and mental states come to an end, and when more and more subtle levels become manifest. Then at the innermost or most subtle level, this state of clear light arises at the moment of dying. Not death. Dying. Physical feeling completely ceases. Breathing ceases. Heart ceases. It's no longer beating. Brain also ceases its functioning. Still subtle, very subtle levels of consciousness remain, getting ready for another destination of life. The consciousness at that moment of death that the Dalai Lama was describing is free of duality and content and abides in the form of pure luminosity. In a popular Hollywood comedy, Caddyshack, there is a scene where Bill Murray's character, Carl, describes a tall tale about carrying golf clubs for the 12th Dalai Lama on a glacier. Carl asks for a tip after the game, and the Dalai Lama is said to have responded, "Oh, there won't be any money, but when you die, on your deathbed, you will receive total consciousness." Perhaps the screenwriters were onto something and knew about the clear light of death meditation. So in Buddhist thought, the Dalai Lama explained, we speak of death, intermediate state, and rebirth. In my case, I undertake this kind of meditation 5 times in a day. So on a daily basis, I kind of go through death and rebirth. 5 times I leave and 5 times I come back. So I suppose, said the Dalai Lama, when I actually die, I should be well prepared. With these words, his twinkling eyes and mischievous smile became thoughtful and tender. But I don't know. When actual death comes, I hope I will have the ability to apply this practice effectively. I don't know. So, I need your prayers. We come now to the end of our program, and we will continue with this book in the coming weeks. As always, I wish you a beautiful, joyous, and peaceful new week. And I look forward to being with you next time on our Philosopher program.